Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2021. And this is a special episode. Probably it will be a bit of a one-off. I doubt it will have the same tenor as the other streams, because I'm here with two men, reactionary expat, the Franklin, as he's now known, and I'm sure he's known to all of you, and also Pale Hominid. Now, Pale Hominid, Pale Hominid had his own YouTube channel back in the day, just in the run-up to the Trump election, I think from 2015 and 2016. And the three of us used to do a monthly, throughout 2016, we did a lot of streams in 2015, but then in 2016 we would do a monthly news roundup. And that stopped when I went to America and it became untenable. But anyway, welcome, the Franklin first.
Hello, thanks for having me again.
Okay, and welcome, Pale Hominid.
Thanks, it's good to see you guys again.
So I guess people will, I've obviously continued, in fact, I'll just tell the history there. So we did a monthly news roundup, and then I went to America in October, and it wasn't tenable to do it that month. And then the next month, I was in America for November. And then the next month, I was back in Scotland and concentrating on Millennial that year, which was the first one with the proper format. And then in the January, I got doxxed. And so everything turned upside down. And that's what ended that thing of doing a monthly news roundup with the three of us, which was sad because I think that people did enjoy them. But you know, there we go, and the rest is history. So it was one of those things that was done and then fell by the wayside. So Franklin, expat, I'm not sure what to call you because for historic reasons people might prefer expat, but obviously now you're known as the Franklin. Is there anything you'd like to say about what I've just said?
No, I think that's a pretty good summary of it.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize that it wasn't a conscious decision on my part to end those streams. Although it has to be said that in 2016, doing a monthly news roundup was actually, it was increasingly depressing, wasn't it? Because, and I didn't keep it disciplined. You know, I remember you saying we should just pick several stories, whereas I was autistically picking up on everything that happened throughout the month, which was really ridiculous. But at that time, and Pale Hominid, perhaps you'd like to come in here. At that time, it seemed like Trump was on the way, and it seemed increasingly like, oh my God, he could actually win. But at the same time, it seemed like, at least in Europe, everything was just falling apart. Is there anything you'd like to say about that?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of energy at that time, and there was a lot going on. I don't have one of the world's sharpest memories for detail, unfortunately. But I do remember that there was a lot going on. And as far as, you know, why we kind of didn't continue to do the monthly hangouts that we used to do, I mean, from my part, a lot was going on in my personal life. I was starting a family, and that's why I stepped away from my YouTube channel around that same time as well. But, yeah, I mean, I remember the news being exciting more than depressing back then, but that may just be kind of the rose-colored memory type of thing.
Well, it was... hold on a sec. Yeah, okay. Franklin, you take it.
Yeah, well, these days I don't even follow the news.
No, so, neither do I. Really.
So those were the halcyon days, I suppose, when I still cared about such things.
Well, I mean, to underline what I mean when I say that everything was falling apart in Europe, I mean that there were terror attacks or terrorist incidents like almost every week at one point. In the summer of 2016, I think there were four or five in Germany alone. And then there were the rapes going on, the migrants. It was just constant. And then in 2017, there were, I think, four in London alone. It was just unbelievable. And then, in France, that priest got beheaded. You know, it was really scary. And, you know, this is the kind of thing where we get vilified for talking about or for having talked about it. But at the time, I was stunned that everyone wasn't talking about it. I mean, it just seemed completely essential that we acknowledge this butchery that's going on all around us. I mean, a weird thing. And of course, this was right after the migrant inflow. What's the migrant crisis of September 2015? You suddenly had millions of Africans and Middle Easterners suddenly newly present in Europe, and there was the ongoing Islamist thing. It was really a scary time. I was genuinely thinking that we were heading towards civil war, civil unrest. I couldn't see how it could evolve in any other direction. It just seemed so obvious.
Yeah, I have a thought on that too. I mean, if there's one thing that I would characterize the time since then, it would be kind of my surprise at how successfully some of the energies of that time have been diverted. Because I think there really was a feeling at that time of like, oh man, there's stuff going on here. You know, the stuff you just talked about in Europe and whatnot. It felt like there was no way that this wasn't building to more of a head of some sort. But there's a lot of stuff that I've been surprised at how it's been kind of successfully neutralized or diverted since then. A lot of different types of energies. There's stuff that it just felt like there was no way people would tolerate indefinitely. I mean, in some ways, though, there's not maybe some of the crises are not quite as profound as they were at that time, or maybe they are even more so, and it's just spread out more, and the media has gotten better at sort of, you know, not covering it in the same way or something. I'm not sure, but I mean, there's definitely the feeling, some of the things that happened over here, I feel like there was a lot of energy up through 2017. And then I feel like much of the story since then has been the system or whatever successfully managing to throw a wet blanket on that energy in various ways, you know. But that's something I was just thinking about recently as well. Is it seems like the reaction to certain things, anytime people would try to do something in real life, do something to show solidarity and stuff, it seems like there's been a successful reaction to that to kind of just take the wind out of sails, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Expat, would you like to chime in here? I muted you earlier because there was background audio.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah.
Yeah, this will take things in a slightly different direction, but it almost seems like that's a completely different era now because especially in the wake of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, it's sort of all of that 20-year period between 9/11 and the recent withdrawal, it's a bit of a head scratcher what all of that was actually about. And obviously the underlying issues haven't gone away, but it does seem like we're moving into a different period where everyone thought that there was going to be this clash of civilizations, and there may yet be, but it's like we have other fish to fry at the moment. We have sort of a more nefarious threat within that we need to recognize and tackle before we can perhaps go back to the inevitable clash of civilizations.
Well, this is part of how strange our age is. That on the one hand, you've got two existential crises going on at once, and one of them actually has to be delayed. This is a debate. You know, does it have to be delayed? I think it does, because the other one is just so all encompassing. But the one that has to be delayed, the demographic thing, is the clock is ticking very fast on that. I mean, I can understand people's frustration and worry that why shouldn't we talk about immigration? From my point of view, it didn't do any good for. Like, I mean, I think about the personal cost to me and other people. Like, and other people have suffered more than I have. it's a huge personal cost that you pay for talking about this stuff publicly. And I also wonder, what good did it do? Because it didn't. I mean, it's still going on. You know, it's still going on as much as it ever did. I wonder if the demographic thing is just something that we're going to have to learn the hard way. Like it's going to have to play out, because in advance, people just are too comfortable and will not confront it.
There's also this other strange issue, though, that I don't know if you've heard this one, that everyone thought that Europe was going to become Islamic, but actually Europe is turning, it seems like the West is turning the whole world gay, that kind of thing. And it's sort of like these guys who have come over to Western nations have become completely deracinated, and they've become the sort of consumer bugman, just like the indigenous populations in these places. It's quite a strange phenomenon. I'm not sure if I've told you this before, but I think I've mentioned it at my channel that my cousin went to school with a guy who later went to fight for ISIS in the Middle East. She went to a fairly multicultural school. This guy went to fight for ISIS in the Middle East. And one might think, well, why would anyone do that from the suburbs of Melbourne? Because the alternative for that kind of guy from a Middle Eastern background is to be a sort of almost a caricature. There was a TV show that featured a sort of multi-racial cast of these guys who worked in a pizza shop as pizza delivery men. And the whole storyline was about these guys are all basically the same, just different ethnicities, all wearing sort of track suits and driving hotted up cars and chasing women and acting like complete idiots. And that's the alternative for these guys. We often think about how we have had our traditions and our cultures and so on eroded, but this is happening all over the world. This is what post-modernity and sort of the global consumerist empire, this is what's happening to everyone in the world and various places, and people are trying to react to that in one way or another. And it may actually be that things like ISIS were a reaction to that, and they've actually lost to that because.
Well, on that note, expat, I just within the last week, I had a reason to need to take an Uber car ride a few times, and the drivers, both times or all, I think it was all three times, were different Muslim men, and they and that was, you know, kind of a thing in and of itself that I was kind of like, that's interesting. But they all seem to be the kind that you're describing, where their any sense of their own culture seemed to be kind of sapped from them. And they, on the radio, they had the music playing that would be comfortable for some, you know, regular American person around here and stuff. And in a way, it's kind of disappointing. It's like, I don't like when you're that other way, but at least it's more authentic. And, you know, it's kind of sad to see somebody have their own actual, the energy and personality of their own people kind of sapped from them. It's weird, you know. I'd rather things just be more clear cut here. And it's like, I don't know, it's weird to be to find yourself in a position where you don't want someone to assimilate, because obviously there's problems when they don't, but, things just get murkier when they do.
Yeah, I'm just reminded of when you did your Brexit Star Trek parody, and you had Worf as a Muslim guy. And what was his name? Was it not something like Lieutenant Al Kebab?
Right. Yeah. That's right. That's right.
But he's supposedly integrated into the culture of Starfleet and so on. But he's still doesn't really speak English.
Yeah, he's mostly just characterized by getting angry when Lieutenant Commander Farage was saying things that he didn't like to hear or whatever. Yeah, that was a long time ago, man. It's amazing because a lot of the people I put in that are just totally off of the radar now, or have, you know, a person could naively believe that a certain person or people at that time had a lot of potential that hasn't really realized itself since then, you know?
Yeah, it's sad. It's a shame. And I do know what you mean about Islam. And I remember a certain YouTuber saying to me, Islam isn't a long-term problem. The demographics don't matter. The religion doesn't matter because the West will cuck Islam. And I remember thinking, first of all, that's not likely. And second, that's not actually a great thing, because that means that even Islam will then be a void of nothingness, like Christianity is at this point. Expat, would you like to chime in?
Yeah, well, it seems like everyone's caught between either just being corroded by this acid of postmodernity that just eats everything away to nothing, turns everything into interchangeable grey goo, or almost they're forced to LARP as this sort of caricature of a traditional version of themselves or what they might consider their ancestors to be. And it's very difficult for people to actually have a modern identity that doesn't fall into one of these traps. And it seems to be happening to everyone all over the world. And various countries are actively trying to resist it, whether we're talking about Russia or Hungary or China or various other places that do seem to be attempting to come down on these things. But the jury is still out as to whether they'll be successful, any of those places, at doing so.
But either way, the febrile atmosphere of 2016 and 17 has dissipated. And yeah, it's something that, it's a mystery to me. And again, we got vilified for talking about it, but it was a very real thing at the time. It was because scary.
I think what's happened since then, at least observing the US from the outside, is that there have been two changes of guard. So on the right, a certain number of people thought that, okay, our guy was in charge and that was going to solve every problem. And then there was a very much hysterical reaction to that from the left. And it was, well, once we get rid of Cheeto Hitler, then everything will be all right. And what both sides are finding out, and this is sort of tied up in the death of the upcoming death of liberalism, people have found out that actually it's not the other guy, the other side's guy who's the problem. It's not the other side. There's a much deeper problem. All these sort of spiritual shortcomings, if you like, are becoming apparent as very deep problems that no one side or politician or political party or anything will solve. These are much deeper issues, and we've almost sort of settled into this quiet period where everyone's just a little bit in shock, and everyone is just trying to come to terms with the fact that actually it's much worse than anyone thought, and we're not quite sure how to address that because it's much worse than everyone thought.
It's existential.
We're sort of in a bit of a stupor, actually, trying to observe it and make any sense of it, and therefore figure out how we can go from here. Because Trump wasn't anyone. He wasn't the guy on the white horse who rode in and saved the West. And getting rid of Trump wasn't the thing that, I mean, it's just gone from bad to worse since they got rid of him, because that was meant to be the end of everyone's problems. And I think you'd be hard pressed, except with perhaps the most rabid leftists, to get people to admit that actually things are better. It seems like there's just this continual degradation.
I think you're...
And no one's really right on sure there. What... And that sucked all of the energy because it's like, all right, well, if Trump wasn't the solution and then Biden isn't the solution, then who is the solution? Which side actually is going to revitalize enough people that will all say, yeah, we feel something? Like, as flawed as things may have been 5 years ago, at least people felt something. But now everyone's just sort of completely innovated.
Well, something that I think reinforces what you're saying there is, if you just think about Biden and Harris. I feel like with Hillary, people on the right had a very legitimate energy toward, you know, how much they disliked her. And I think she was like someone that, whether wrongly or rightly, they had this feeling of, oh man, if she was the president, that would be incredibly horrible. And it was this real, you know, good versus evil thing in their mind. Biden, I feel like every time people try to generate either positive or negative feelings toward him and in his administration, it feels very forced. It doesn't feel natural like it did with Hillary. It's kind of like, I think you're exactly right. People now perceive that there's something behind these characters that's the real issue. And I don't think anyone truly believes that Biden is the actual issue. I don't know if that's because of his age and people perceive him as not really being competent. And so it's just, it's not believable that he's the one actually running things, or if it's because of other things about his character. But, you know, with regard to sort of the wind being taken out of sails and stuff, I think a lot of people, or some people, believe that the whole COVID thing largely functions as just a distraction to get people away from thinking about things the way they did before and focusing on the things they were focused on. I have no idea if that is the case. I don't know what to make of that whole thing.
What I would say to that is, either way, it does do that.
And so, yes, it's functioning in that way regardless, yeah.
Exactly. And so, and this is why, whether it's a deliberate ploy or not, it does do that. And so for us to then talk about demographics, while everyone else is obsessed with COVID, it's just tone deaf, I think. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, well, people are literally locked up and going crazy. They're literally losing their jobs and they're not sure where they're going to be a month from now or 6 months from now. They don't want to think about 20 years from now. They're just struggling to get by. That's been one of the major themes of the past 2 years, that people have just been reeling from blow after blow and just trying to stay on their feet.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, we can say, well, it shouldn't be like that. Don't let them do that to you. You've got to keep thinking about demographics. But that's like saying, look, I just want you to be able to fly. Why can't you just fly? Just decide to fly. Just do it. They're not going to do it. That's the issue here. I don't know. But another thing I wanted to say is about Joe Biden is that wasn't even on the radar 5 years ago. I mean, he was there. I think he was the... Was he not the vice president to Barack Obama? But yeah. But no one ever, I mean, I don't remember him being a figure that people talked about. I think because he is just bland. There's really not much to say about him, except that now he's senile. So people talk about that. So, I mean, it sounds very shallow, but that's my impression.
I don't know if you recall, but during the primaries, there was, for the majority of that time, I mean, there was a period early on where he was perceived as kind of the natural front runner because he had been the vice president before. But for most of that primary period, people didn't think he had a chance because there was no real energy behind him. Nobody actually was excited about Joe Biden. And so I think people were looking to these other characters, whether it be Elizabeth Warren, there were different people who actually had legitimate energy behind them. He was not one of them. And so it was a real weird thing how he ended up at the top of that heap. And I think it contributed, along with other things about how the election went and whatnot, it contributed to a general feeling of fakeness. I think there's a real feeling of fakeness around a lot of things, especially with regard to politics since then. It just feels very contrived. I think whether people can put their finger on it or not, everyone feels like their energies are being misdirected, like the real issues are being cloaked in some way, and that people perceive that, and it creates a weird atmosphere, and it becomes hard to generate, let alone direct, energies.
Well, exactly. Franklin.
Yeah, in some strange way, he's actually the perfect man for the moment. It's, you know, people talk about his senility, and he's a deeply flawed and corrupt individual, but he actually manages to hide a lot of that. In some ways, he's actually the perfect representation of where the West is at right now, that it is senile and it is corrupt, but there's this bland respectability or something over the top of it. He's sort of Teflon in some sense. And he's almost like the storm before the calm or some sort of placeholder or something. And people may well look back in several years. Odd as this may sound, people may look back in a few years and say, well, weren't those the good times? Because everything was actually kind of somewhat stable, even though all this other stuff was bubbling below the surface. At least it was somewhat, the lid was somewhat on the pot still.
Yeah. I think that what we've got just now is this threat of supply line shortages, which doesn't seem to have amounted to much yet. I've certainly not seen any great sign of that, but it was being touted a few months ago as, you know, a threat. And then, of course, the other aspects of the Great Reset that they are talking. I mean, this isn't something that we are just deciding to be worried about or concerned with. They're talking about it a lot. And there are, you know, intermittently clips are released of Klaus Schwab or these other figures whose names we don't even know, saying rather ominous things. And that's another aspect of it, that it's ominous. It's not hopeful and upbeat. Klaus Schwab is, I mean, he's a fucking miserable character. Even looking at any random photo of him, he looks like he's just realized that someone's stolen his sandwich. That's the look on his face every single time I see a photo of him. And it's weird that he's the front man for this. But it's strangely indicative, or is the word endemic, that all of these world leaders, they are not preaching something optimistic or happy. You'd think that they would at least put that veneer on it. Okay, what we're doing is sinister, but we're going to paint it as something happy, clappy. But they're not doing that. They're actually making it seem as sinister as fuck. I mean, not just COVID, but all of their plans that depend on COVID. It's a strange thing. Either of you want to comment on that?
Well, I think I spoke a little bit about this yesterday. I think they're going to try, but I don't think they'll pull it off. I just don't think people are going to buy this. I don't think they can pivot very easily from become a deracinated consumer to, oh, well, actually consumption is bad. Because that level of consumerism replaced a lot of traditional ways of doing things and habits and thoughts. Well, if they then pull that thing out, what remains? People, I think a lot of people in one way or another are trying to grasp at some level of meaning, and they're going to have something in that space. I don't think they're going to be successful in just saying, all right, basically all of you are just going to be completely caught in the matrix or something. You're going to be grey goo. Just don't think they're going to be successful at that.
Pill hominid, do you want to chime in here?
Well, I don't have a lot of interesting thoughts on that, but, you know, speaking of the Matrix, I'm hearing that the new film is weird. I haven't seen it, but I'm hearing the new film is weird and has kind of a very forced feel to it. Like, apparently they even reference making it just because the studio forced them to, or something, like within the movie itself is what I'm hearing. And then, something, if I have a bit of another topic I can switch to, if you're interested in, it has to do with the, some of the trials that have been going on for police officers and whatnot, but I'll hold that until you want to talk about it. I don't really have any other interesting thoughts right now.
Well, the Matrix 4, I mean, that's all I know about it is the trailer that was released a few months ago, and that the two directors, or whatever they are, the writer, director, who were brothers, are now sisters over the course of the last 20 years. And then today I saw a thing where it's a conversation between Keanu and Trinity, and she's saying, I remember wanting children, but is that just because that's what women are supposed to want? And how do you know whether you've been programmed with a desire or whether it's... and, you know, the thing is, I Googled it, and the actress, Carrie-Anne Moss, has had three children, right? So it doesn't even matter. She is, it interested me because I thought she, by her own instincts, by her own nature or whatever, she's had three children. But then when it comes to serving Globo Homo, she does it. Is she sincerely questioning whether she actually had three children just because the culture told her to? I mean, does that... I think this is wankery. I think that she... I find it hard to imagine that she looks at her children and thinks, I only had you because the culture told me to... I mean, you don't do... Who the hell has three children because culture tells them to? It just seems ridiculous. Does either of you want to chime in there?
Well, and the very idea that it would be wrong to utilize your life in a way that's doing what you're expected to do for your community and stuff. I mean, they managed to characterize something in a negative light. Yes, I agree that people are not having children for that reason, but there may be some truth to the idea that, oh, this is something you're supposed to do. I'm supposed to have a family. And I'm sure that has been part of the reason that people have done it. For a long time, I think it was just kind of the ocean that they were swimming in or whatever. But yes, I'm sure that there have been some times when, to the extent that people even made a choice about it one way or the other, you know, since the era of birth control and other things like that, I'm sure that there have been people who felt, oh, this is what you do. This is what's expected.
Yeah, you're probably right. I'm probably
being I saw an SNL thing, Saturday Night Live thing, just the other day, where it was a skit about, and that's an awful show these days, by the way, very rough to watch, because if you're someone, especially like me, who has a strong sense of like secondhand embarrassment, it's very difficult to watch that show. But the skit that they were doing was about these two grandmothers who just could not stop harping on wanting grandchildren. In a way, it's actually kind of about the closest thing to wholesome I've seen from them in a while, because at least they're portraying some grandmothers who want grandchildren. But that's, you know, that's a stereotype, is that, oh, you know, the mom is pressuring her daughter to give her grandchildren or whatever. And that was the whole theme of the skit. But the reason I think of it is because, yes, there are still, even now, there are occasionally sources of, pressure, encouragement on people to have kids. But the very idea that that would be a problem, that there's something wrong with that, or that your mother and father aren't entitled to expect and want and express that desire for grandchildren, these are all just deeply wrongheaded, way off the mark ways to be thinking about the situation. I mean, if you ever look at Reddit, there's people on there, they have this like child free group, and it's just the endless harping they do about, oh my God, the expectations placed upon us to have children and stuff. And, it's amazing how much energy people can generate in a negative sense towards something that, you know, is absolutely fulfilling and absolutely what they should be doing ideally. You know, not everyone is going to do that, but it's just, anyway, I'm rambling.
Well, I think you're right. I jumped the gun saying that people don't have kids because the culture tells them to. You're right that they're, Franklin, could you mute when you're not speaking? Thanks. You're right that there is a cultural thing there. But the thing is, it's right that there, because otherwise society isn't going to survive. So it's right that there is a cultural expectation there. I think that thing with the Matrix, it relates to this idea that to be programmed by culture at all is terrible. And there's some sort of inner truth. And there is inner truth. There is your own intrinsic nature. And I think that in a sense, yes, you do have to be true to your nature as long as it's helpful to be. I mean, I don't think that someone who is a psychopath or something should be true to their nature. I think they should endeavor to be to thwart that nature as much as possible. But either way, the idea that culture and cultural pressure is always a bad thing, again, this actually does relate to fundamental issues of this age. There's this mistrust of all culture, which it means that everything is up for grabs. Nothing is certain. But then tied with that is this total faith and total trust in egalitarianism.
I have one more thought about that and how it ties in with the So the thing with Carrie Ann Moss, that was a clip from the movie. Is that what you're saying?
I believe so. I didn't see the clip. Well, it was subtitled.
Okay. Understood. Well, I think it's, as with anything else, there's always, it depends, you know, that's the ultimate story of most of these things, is it depends, right? So the people who would, that they are targeting that kind of message toward, and what would resonate with them about those kind of things, they don't mind the idea of, you know, culture dictating your behaviors. They're very big on it lately, especially. They very much like the idea that you would fall in line with things surrounding COVID and whatnot. But it's specifically about having kids there that they're targeting. They want, so the first Matrix movie was big on portraying like getting a normal job and work. You know, they showed the Neo guy was working like a desk job, and they portrayed that very effectively as like, this is siphoning his spirit and this is not what he's supposed to be doing with his life. And he has been successfully neutralized by the system in the fact that he has this cubicle desk job, right? Now, there may be some truth to that, of course, but that was kind of the what they were going for with that, at least in the early part of that first film. Now, it sounds like they, I think what I've heard and the impression I get is that this new film focuses much more on the Trinity character, the Carrie Ann Moss character. And I think that they are probably going for a similar sort of feel of this brave, stunning woman who was a badass, you know, defeating 10 dudes at the same time and whatnot in the first movie. She's now been neutralized. She has had the, she has had her energies diverted, and the system has won by getting her to have children or even want to have children. That is the neutralization of her, is that she's become a mother, which is about the most, awful message you could send to a woman, is that, but that's exactly the message that they've been sending for decades, is like, you have had, you've successfully had your spirit and your fire like doused as a woman if you kind of just cave and you just end up having kids. Such a sad, think of all the things you could have done with your life. And you know, I actually, to go back to the Reddit thing, I look at there occasionally, and I saw something earlier today actually where someone had posted this picture of just a handwritten note from some sort of like mommy blogger or something. And she had put on there, you know, the pros and cons on one side, the pros of being a stay-at-home mom, on the other side, you know, the cons of working as a wife and whatnot. And this was fairly unobjectionable. It was just somebody who was a stay-at-home mom and in favor of that lifestyle and trying to point out the benefits of it. And creating this for the consumption of her own fans and stuff anyway, it really didn't seem like the kind of thing that could get anybody upset. If there were other people not pursuing that lifestyle, then fair enough. But the comment section in the Reddit post where somebody had put this image up was just, it was amazing how much anger they were able to generate from this thing that was in no way, I couldn't see how it would generate anger. Again, if it's not the kind of lifestyle you're interested in, just move along, right? But they were very angry that someone would just, every comment was, well, what about the husband?
I think this antinatalism, it's a cult that people get into, and it functions very much as a cult. It demands a total loyalty and obsessiveness. And then they become obsessive and they become very, I mean, I remember someone saying the same thing about being an SJW, that they spent most of their time feeling angry at the world because it just would never match up to their expectations and their demands. And I think the same is true of antinatalists, but also with them, they're fighting against their own nature. In the same way that the Zoomer teenager or millennial teenager of a few years ago who got into the trans thing and then realizes actually that this really isn't for me, this is not, I thought it was who I was, and but really I was just getting caught up in a fad. I think in the same way you get these antinatalists who are fighting against their own nature, and really it's either hang-ups that they've got that are causing them to get into this, or it's, you know, fear of sex, or it's some sort of obsession with individual liberty, but they know that they do have at some level this desire to have children, and they're fighting against it, which would make sense that would result in a lot of angst. The Franklin expat, would you like to chime in here?
Sure. A couple of things. The first thing is with regard to, what's her name? Carrie-Anne Moss. Carrie-Anne Moss. We may be overthinking this in that she's probably, I don't know how much she's getting paid for this movie, but let's just pick a figure, $5 million. So they're going to throw $5 million at her to do something dumb, say something dumb. I mean, how many people do and say dumb things? Not everybody's, I don't know, Laurence Olivier or something. So there are lots of people getting paid to do dumb things for Hollywood. But then just look at her revealed preferences. So I might be like, yeah, okay, I'll take the $5 million and then I'll go back to living my life on my own terms. So maybe she's actually clever in that regard. She's just playing the game. You know, we might be overthinking it in that regard.
No, you're right. I mean, yeah, she may very well be thinking of her children most of all in taking that. I mean, that's absolutely true. And I don't think she's someone you have. On the other hand, you have Keanu, who he's still getting a lot of roles and whatnot. I don't think she gets a lot of opportunities to make a paycheck like that these days or ever.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I think too. I imagine, she's just cashing in. It's her last opportunity to do so, probably. Women famously don't have much of a career in Hollywood once they get old. There are very few women who last beyond their into their 30s, even. So, look, she might just be cashing in. On the topic more broadly of antinatalism, I tend to sort of look at these things like that. To some extent, there'll be self-correcting problems. As long as we can cordon these people off and say, okay, keep them away from people like us so that they're not going to affect us, so that they're not going to affect our children, let them become a self-correcting problem, because they will. I don't really have too much else to say other than that.
Well, when it comes to women who try to do both, I just saw a little bit ago an example. I don't know if this case was on you guys' radar at all or not, because it was not as big as like the Derek Chauvin case and whatnot. But Kim Potter, middle-aged female cop in the same exact area or very close to where the Chauvin George Floyd thing happened, she has just been found guilty of manslaughter for this was the woman who meant to use her taser on a gentleman of color who was fleeing and endangering her and her partner by moving the car while the other cop was inside of it and stuff. She said, taser, 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 but she accidentally grabbed her gun and shot him once, and then he died. And, you know, there's definitely conversations around this to be had about, you know, whether, you know, a middle-aged mom, I think she's got like five kids or something, whether someone like that should be a police officer at all, tasked with like physically trying to grapple with criminals and stuff. That's one conversation, but I mean, she tried to do, as far as the career or the family, she tried to do both, and she I'm actually blown away that she was found guilty, because I did not watch the entire trial, but I watched some of it, and I was watching coverage of, you know, from lawyers who were analyzing it and watching the whole thing and whatnot, and everything seemed to be pointing in the direction of a not guilty verdict on this one. And I'm kind of amazed that she would be found. It really does feel like a cynical, oh, we don't want riots type of verdict. And the Chauvin thing, you know, was an easier one to see how they would get there, especially with all the hype around that and whatnot. But that was a real disappointment, that he was found guilty as well. It really does feel like, even when you're like a relatable, nice, middle-aged mom type character, at this point, you can get totally thrown under the bus as a police officer. Now, there may be issues with police officers, but I can't help but feel really awful for this woman. You know, she actually had been on the force for like 25 years. Everything about her records and her commendations and everything indicated that she was like top notch. As you know, now maybe she was not it sounds like she never had had a reason to fire her weapon before or anything like that in all those years. So it may be that she was able to be a top-notch cop as long as that meant, like, you're going to all the trainings, you're doing, like, the potluck on Friday or whatever. And, like, you know, maybe she was only a great cop in the sense of, like, as long as the job remained approximately the same as being, like, an office woman or something, you know. And when it actually came time to deal with somebody who was physically resisting and stuff, maybe that all fell apart at that point. But it was very clear. I don't think there was the prosecution, and by the way, the same prosecutors as the Chauvin trial were involved in this one as well. I don't think that they ever even tried to accuse her of having done it deliberately. It was always acknowledged that it was a mistake. And they, you know, they had use of force experts and whatnot who talked about how, you know, muscle memory and if, you know, how that could easily happen and whatnot. I don't think the jury understood the laws surrounding negligence versus recklessness. That was the big determiner here. Anyway, this is a big distraction. And if you guys aren't interested in talking about it, that's fine. But I was thinking of it again because while we've been talking, I saw that she was found guilty. And it seems to kind of tie in with the whole idea of like working woman versus mom and stuff. But again, if you're not interested, we can move on.
I've never even heard of this. This is entirely same here.
The shooting itself happened, I think, August of last year. So it was definitely, you know how there was that whole feeling of, you know, hyper scrutiny on any kind of police incident around the country in the wake of the Chauvin Floyd thing. She was definitely one of those ones who probably got a lot more attention because of the atmosphere at that time, and especially because it was right in the same area.
I just don't know how anyone could be a cop in America today. You know, it seems so.
There's a lot of jobs right now that are having trouble finding people, but that's definitely, they started having massive trouble before COVID came. And so I'm sure that is just making it even worse. And yes, every time one of these verdicts comes down, it sends a clear message to people that, you know, why the hell would you want to pursue a career in law enforcement, you know?
I remember you... Oh, sorry, Franklin, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it does seem like anyone who goes into the... Look, it might be one thing for someone who's 5 years away from retirement or something like that, but, yeah, I'm stunned that anyone would go into it now as a new career. It just seems like you're playing Russian roulette.
Yeah. Pale Homin, I completely agree, expat. It just seems, you know, how long is it going to be before you're in that situation where if you make the wrong split-second decision, you will ruin your life. You'll be dragged through the courts and all the rest of it. Pale Homin, I can remember you saying, I think you said it to me privately. I don't know if you said this in a video or on a stream, that the story of... Black civil rights in America is the story of, well, actually, the story of white people, white Americans and black Americans coexisting is the story of whites trying to learn how to live alongside blacks because they are so different. You know, this is the kind of thing that we can say on Odyssey. So it's a bit strange for me to be speaking in these terms again. But I think we're safe in doing this. Because they're so different that for white Americans, it's difficult, even with all, you know, centuries of experience, it's still difficult for them to know how to do it. And the way that the American ancestors found to do it was to dominate them. And indeed, it's been said about in Africa as well, that the only way to coexist with them is to dominate them and to constantly reinforce that, because otherwise they will rebel and you'll have a disaster on your hands.
Pill well, on. If everything about the white person is that they've been genetically calibrated to run their predictive behavior of another person you're interacting with, if all of those behavior predictor models that, you know, happen in the white brain are all based on the behavior you'd expect from another white person, then it's very ill-equipped to... I mean, that's the story of so many of these. You'll see so many of these police interactions and whatnot, and it's clear that just the behavior patterns are just so different than what you would expect from most white people. The reactions to things, you know, there's, I think one of the biggest things is there is a point of, for the vast majority of white people, there's a point in these kind of situations where you're just kind of like, you know what, you got me, time to just sort of resign myself to going through this process. And that just doesn't happen for a lot of more vibrant types, you know? And I think that there's so much volatility to these interactions, and it makes it so difficult for a police officer or someone who's just kind of, you know, maybe finds themselves in like a civilian self-defense scenario. But the cops oftentimes look harsh to us because they are like the one type of white person who just through raw volume of exposure has finally gotten to the point where their predictive model toward, you know, black men or whatever, is actually fairly accurate. So from the outside looking in, if all you see is just the few minutes of interaction, in one of these high profile cases, it's hard for you to understand the police behavior. Now, it's not hard for me to understand it, but there's a lot of people who, if you don't, and that's why I've always said for years, I've always said these people who, get outraged about these shootings and stuff, or even just get outraged about the stats of like, oh my God, there's so many black men in prison and stuff. I wish that they could be forced to do like a ride along with the Detroit, or East St. Louis police for like 2 weeks straight, just nighttime ride alongs with the cop. I think that it would be very eye-opening for people, you know. A shame that that show Cops got canceled and stuff. And I think it got canceled during the whole, like, kind of the Floyd era where everything was... I mean, it's actually amazing.
That's St. Floyd, too.
Right, exactly. Well, it's amazing when you look back at it just how much was done in reaction to that, you know, how many things were destroyed and attempts to, that's the thing. I thought there's been different times over the course of the last 20 years, maybe, that I've thought the era of kind of appeasement or trying to adapt to their behavior in the cuckish manner was coming to an end. But it still always surprises me just how far people are prepared or able to go in the sort of appeasement direction with that, you know?
One thing that's interesting is, in retrospect, how there were foreshadowings of things that have happened over the last 2 years. And one of them is after the, I've forgotten where it happened, but the Dylann Roof massacre, which I think we can all agree was an insane and stupid thing for him to do. But after that happened, the media set about demonizing the Confederate flag. And this was, I think, 2015. And then suddenly all, you know, big tech got on board and Amazon banned anything, any products, eBay, I think, as well, banned any products that had the Confederate flag. And that, I think, is a foreshadowing, you know, in retrospect, you can see it that way, of, well, the statues getting taken down last year. You know, anything, because it was shocking because they're statues. But it's not shocking. It shouldn't have been surprising. Franklin, do you have anything to say there?
Well, it's just formalism, right? It's power being formalized. So if statues are a physical representation of an idea and who has power, they get to display it physically so that you see it everywhere you go. It's just formalizing that idea. And when a regime changes, they will remove the formal symbols of power of the previous regime. And it's just that, I think. And in many ways, whilst it's shocking, it may even be preferable because then there are no illusions about what's really going on. We're no longer living in the 1990s where people could believe that everything's cool. You know, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto, or however that phrase goes. Yeah. And I think people need to come to terms with that. In many ways, this represents kind of the death of liberalism. I mean, the broader thing that people are going to have to come to terms with is that this liberal project of blank slateism and, well, if we just do this thing, we'll reform these people, we'll bring them to this level, or we can all be the same if we just do the right things and so on. People ultimately are going to have to reject all of that. They're going to have to come to the understanding that how long has this been going on for now? How many things have been tried? At what point do you admit that the entire project is flawed from the outset, or has been flawed from the outset? Eventually they're going to get there, but they've still got a few more spins of the wheel before they get there, I guess. Maybe, you know, like it's hard to sort of gauge how the normies come at this, because I'm considerably more red-pilled or however you want to describe it. But I just sort of look at all of this and say, well, you know, they're going to have to go through this process. And this is all just the death throes of liberalism, if you like, late-stage liberalism.
Yes, I would say, pale hominid, do you want to say something?
Well, the only thing that I would mention there, I mean, when you talk about kind of the removal of statues and whatnot, American Renaissance had a good video. It's their most recent video. It was comparing that whole sort of push to remove all those statues in the U.S. to what the Taliban did with, you know, bombing the, I think, I can't remember.
Buddhist.
Yeah, the Buddhas and whatnot. And, yeah, I thought it was a good video. Good comparison. I mean, it's actually remarkable. I was thinking about this when I saw that video. It's remarkable that there's anywhere in the world. It's really a testament to the stability of any given region if you even see anything that's that old, because it means that for that entire time, actually, I was thinking about this the other day too. I mean, there's some cemeteries and whatnot here in the U.S. that, of course, by European standards aren't that old, but I remember seeing some cemeteries that dated back to 1700s, maybe even 1600s. And you think to yourself, for even something like that, for that kind of time period, for this headstone to still be here requires that entire time there's never been some little shit that entire time who was just like, you know what, I'm just going to destroy that because it's old and because I'm in a bad mood or whatever. I mean, that entire time there has to have never been someone like that. And then if you think about a statue that's been up for a couple of thousand years and whatnot, that means that entire time there cannot have at any time been someone who's motivated, who had the power and said, you know, I don't want this to be here because it represents something we don't identify with anymore and that kind of thing. So it's really a strong testament to the stability and calm nature of people in any given area that they're at least able to appreciate things enough to leave them be and allow them to pass to the next generation after them. You know, I'm sure that for every statue that there has been, there have been people since that time who could have taken issue with them and said, we don't really approve of this person and their actions anymore. We don't identify with this person anymore. But it, you know, in the cases where it was left alone, I think that's great. You know, that's how you actually end up with a place that has some history to it.
This is an interesting thing, because those statues were there, like in Britain, you know, these various statues that have now been taken down, and the statue of Cecil Rhodes in Cambridge, or is it Oxford? I can't remember. Anyway, they've been there all this time. In the 2000s, most people, as students at that university, did not support the state of Rhodesia, but they tolerated the statue of Cecil Rhodes being there. So, I mean, it's not like they were in support of that concept anymore, but they tolerated and accepted that, well, of course that statue is there because it's part of the history of this place. We now have this attitude now that nothing can be tolerated that is not in keeping with the morals and attitudes of today. That's a new idea.
Well, the most dangerous thing is now they know, oh, they're like, oh, we can do that? You know, for I think a long time they were just kind of like, oh, that's just something that's there. And they didn't really view it as a possibility to get rid of these things. But now they definitely know that none of these things can't be targeted for this. And so it leads to a real runaway train effect of, you know, any given cluster of shitlibs anywhere is going to be like, well, why aren't we actively trying to take down this statue that we have here at our university or we have here in our town? It's almost like in order to fully live up to what they are, they have to be working toward that, you know, and it gives them a feeling of accomplishment too.
Well, and in order to be consistent, all of these things have to be got rid of, because once one of them is got rid of, it becomes a sort of outrage that this other one is still being tolerated. You know, you get this situation like on social media when, well, YouTube have banned Stefan Molyneux. It's your turn now, Twitter. Why aren't you doing the right thing? It's a similar thing with the statues. You know, it becomes a cudgel. Expat.
Yeah, I disagree slightly in the sense of this being a new thing, because there has been a fair amount of iconoclasm in the past. So we had, say, during the English Civil War, there was a fair amount of it then. The Reformation and Counter-Reformation. Also at the end of antiquity and into the early part of the Middle Ages. Perhaps why we're not as aware of this is because it was so successful. So there were a lot of lot of pagan statues that were defaced. There were a lot of sacred pagan sites where the sacred trees and so on were cut down, and indeed cathedrals were built over them specifically so that they couldn't regrow or replant these things. So there have been these things before. It's not entirely a new phenomenon in the West.
Oh, I didn't mean that it was a new phenomenon, that it's never happened before in world history. I just meant that for us it's a new thing.
Well, I just saw a tweet earlier today that claimed that there's an estimate that up to 97% of the art in Great Britain, or in England at least, that existed at the time of all the monasteries being closed by Henry V or whatever it was, that up to 97% of the art that existed in the country might have been lost and destroyed at that time. I don't know. That seems awfully high. But if it was concentrated, it showed a map of all the monasteries that were closed at that time. And it's kind of believable with just how many monasteries were closed. If that was the primary location that the art existed and whatnot, then maybe that is true.
That would be incredible. But, you know, this gets us back to the time that we're in now, where if 97% of modern art was destroyed, I mean, who would shed a tear? Other than the art dealers.
PJW might have to stop making certain videos, I guess, but...
that's a sort of depressing thing. Expat, earlier on you mentioned alternative comedy and how this should be an era that's ripe for new comedy. We haven't even mentioned the cultural freeze of the last 20 years. That's something that has come up in several other streams. But one aspect of that is obviously comedy, because comedy is supposed to react to not just current events, but the current social fabric. And yet that is not happening at all.
Yeah, well, it's like the school moms have got in charge. And to some extent, that's always been the case with people in power. But I think that the entire narrative of the past several decades has been whitewashed, is perhaps an inappropriate term, but whitewashed, in that comedy was meant to be this subversive thing. And there was a notion of it being subversive universally, but actually I think that was just a means to subvert the existing culture in the West. And once it had done that job, then they were willing to discard it, because it does seem like there are so many absurdities around that this really should be a golden age for comedy. Some people said, well, we've got memes and things like that. I still don't quite think they're not in the same realm as a classic comedy film or one of those sort of stand-up specials. I remember those stand-up specials from the 80s. And well, even more recently, probably 5 or 10 years ago, there was a big thing with those guys like Louis C.K. and Bill Burr and those kinds of guys who did these comedy specials. I guess they tried to cancel, what's his name? Who's the Dave Chappelle? They tried to cancel him recently, unsuccessfully. But it does seem like there is so much material. The system is so full of absurdities, and these hysterical people should be so easy to lampoon. I mean, just the COVID thing alone should have produced 100 incredible stand-up specials. But I think that's all testament to the fact that comedy over the past few decades was allowed to be subversive because it was subverting the correct thing. Now it's mission accomplished, they don't want that anymore. There's no use for comedy. But it should be. I'm surprised that there isn't kind of an alternative thing. Like, I'm surprised that there isn't someone who is massive on Odyssey, for instance, and who would then break free of that and be shared around by normies and that sort of thing, because it seems like it's just begging to happen. I mean, I'm not the guy to do it. I'm not a funny guy. But it seems like I'm very surprised that that just hasn't happened yet.
Well, what I can tell you is that there's an alternative comedy thing in London that once a month they do this show, and it has been attacked by Antifa. And, you know, and it's sort of like Sargon tier civic nationalism.
Yeah, is that one with they have a yellow banner? I'm trying to think. Yeah. Is it that one?
Comedy Unleashed.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, and is that somehow... And then there are those two guys. They have a YouTube channel, I think, and they're comedians.
Oh,
I
don't find God.
There's one guy, he's Russian-Jewish originally. Yeah. And then there's this sort of pudgy English... I think he's English, I'm not sure.
Yes, he is, and he's got the most annoying laugh on planet Earth.
Yeah, do you know the two? Constantine Kieran and Kissin.
And I've actually seen him at that comedy club. He looked away from me.
Yeah, trigonometry. Someone's mentioned it.
Yeah,
trigonometry, yeah.
Which is just awful stuff. I mean, because it pretends to be
edgy
and controversial. It's interesting. It's like, the club gets attacked by Antifa intermittently. And I dare say that these comedians are thwarted in various ways. I mean, they're not going to get shows at mainstream comedy clubs. But even so, for all of that, they are still allowed. They're still allowed to exist and to do what they do. Now, they're thwarted. They're kept at a low level, but they are tolerated. Now, if there were a comedian who was making jokes about more serious topics, he simply would not be allowed. It simply would not be allowed to happen. If the state didn't get him on hate speech charges, Antifa would attack his house and attack him physically.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's right. Are you aware of Stone Toss? Do you know Stone Toss?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, obviously, that's different to stand up comedy.
Yeah. And I don't even know. Exactly. I don't know if anyone knows who he is. The worst that will happen to him, and it is a serious thing, is that he'll get deplatformed. But until his identity is revealed, Antifa cannot, they can't go to his house, smash windows, spray paint the walls or whatever, and they can't attack him. But with stand-up comedians, you can't be a stand-up comedian without revealing who you are. So, this is an example of how, maybe this is part of why we have this cultural freeze, because change simply isn't allowed anymore. That might be, I'm not saying that is the answer, because, aesthetics and so on, you wouldn't think that would be politically offensive, but you can see why comedy would be politically offensive.
Of the videos of Sam Hyde? I don't think he does this anymore, but when he used to go a few years back, he used to go to comedy clubs like Open Mic Night. And I think it's been a while since I've watched some of these, but I believe his strategy was basically to overdo he would kind of pretend he was an anti-white liberal type person, and he would just make it ridiculous and go over the top with it. And it was pretty clear to the audience after a short period of time that he was actually the other thing, pretending and making fun of it by performative, mockery. That might be a good approach, I guess, but I don't know if he's doing that anymore.
Yeah, well, it surprises me that more of that isn't being done. Actually, I saw one guy at the what's that, Comedy Unleashed? I think he was there, a guy called Will Franken. He did this whole thing about Greta Thunberg and climate change. And
yeah, I saw him live several times. He actually fell out with them because I think he is pretty mad, like, pretty insane.
Yeah, like, sure.
For real. That, and he just can't get along with anyone. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's that was pretty edgy, that skit. He did this whole thing about her being a puppet, this kind of demonic puppet controlled by some German guy called someone Heimlich or something. But yeah, it was pretty edgy. Talking about climate change
and
about Brexit at the time, but too.
There's also the issue that, you know, you get these people like him who are edgy up to a point, but then they gatekeep for anything beyond them. I mean, I can actually, well, one of the times that I saw him live, out of nowhere, he went into a rant about how intelligence is not genetically governed.
Well, and he's a member of the tribe, isn't he?
So of course. Oh, of course.
So there's
of
that course. Too.
But I know. And that, what I'm saying is that's probably the only reason he's allowed to have a career at all. And, yeah. You know, but anything that would actually address the real salient issues of our time, he would, no, you're not going to get that from him or from Comedy Unleashed. I mean, they will talk about climate change. They'll make jokes about that. They'll make jokes about the coof and, oh, we've all got to wear masks. and they'll even touch on the trans thing. But race is absolutely out of bounds. I mean, there's no way. Even Islam. In fact, what I've noticed there is that they'll have a black comedian on who'll talk about his dick. I mean, it's like, it's the most stereotypical stuff. Like, every fucking black comedian has to talk about his dick. And he does, you know, I've seen, I think, two different black comedians there just come up and do that. And what's more, all of the non-white comedians talk about racism. You know, they'll make little jibes about, you know, yeah, it's difficult growing up not white in this country. It's unfucking believable, you know, because this is supposed to be edgy. And from my point of view, you know, I've been there a few times. It's you know, some of it is funny, but a lot of it is just like, fucking hell. I mean, it's like, from my point of view, it's like going back 10 or 15 years in time. And this is the issue. This is all you're allowed. Fuck.
Yeah, but I'm still surprised that there aren't more people like Sam Hyde doing the extreme parody of the extreme middle class lefty, because they could kind of sneak in the back door, so to speak, and then it seems like there should be a golden age for that kind of stuff. These people are so easy to mock, like that Sam Hyde, what is it, Paradigm Shift 2070. I mean, that whole TED talk scene was just begging for that, because those people took themselves so seriously. It just seems like there'd have to be someone doing something on Odyssey or something like that, and it would break out at some point. It would break out into normiedom.
I mean, hopefully Odyssey will grow to a point where it can create cultural things like that. You know, where a comedian actually could start his career on Odyssey, because certainly it wouldn't be allowed on YouTube at this point. I don't think. But this is, again, with stand-up comedy, the same thing I think applies to rock music. It was allowed to be subversive for 50 years, but now that's not needed anymore. What is now required of rock music is that it be conformist. And so this is how you get the Kaiser Chiefs singing the praises of the, you know, global big pharma, which is just astounding.
Yeah, well, you've got Rage for the Machine, you know, fuck you all exactly as you tell me.
Exactly. And then in the same way, you've got YouTube, which ostensibly is for independent content creators, but really that was needed for a while, or at least it was tolerated for a while, but now they don't have any time for that. I mean, I really think that 5 years from now, YouTube will be just CNN, the BBC.
Well, so much of... Go ahead.
That will be the opportunity, though, because it's like Are you aware of that guy? What's his name? Paul Scullis or something like that. The Lindy guy. And there's some funny memes around him being Nassim Taleb's son and all this sort of stuff. But that guy, his whole thing, one of his big things is culture is stuck. And it's like, yeah, well, name a film from the past 10 years that was iconic. And it's really difficult to think of things like that or name a band or an album or what have you that's iconic in a way that the Beatles were or Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin or The Cure or, you know, any of these bands before were huge rallying points. And the fact that those things don't exist because everything is so contained to me suggests that should be the perfect environment for something to break out, and people will latch onto it immediately because they'll be so desperate for something that's real, that's actually has some soul to it. So whilst they may try to contain it, I'm optimistic in this regard that, yeah, it's all crap now, but sooner or later something is going to break out. There will be some new artistic movement, some new comedic movement, whatever it is, because people are just so sick of this bland crap, essentially.
It's telling that this new Spider-Man movie is doing so well when it's like the whole premise of it is to basically recycle stuff from the early 2000s Spider-Man films. I mean, it's emblematic of where people are at. They just want something that's... there's a lot of appetite for nostalgia right now, that's for sure. And there's also an appetite for any kind of product that predates some of the aggressive PC crap or whatever you want to call it now. I mean, that's one of the kind of pathways you can use to not have to appease that crap as much. It's like, oh, well, we're doing a thing where we're hearkening back to this other product or whatever, you know. And because we're being authentic to that earlier thing, that's kind of our get out of woke free card to a certain degree.
Sorry, I was just replying to a comment in the live chat. Yeah, I mean, the danger, because this is what I've been thinking about for the last 3 or 4 years. The sticking point here is that any company which started up to do and was doing this kind of thing would easily be deplatformed by the payment processors and by their bank. I mean, that's the level of control that is now possible over, you know.
I think so much of what we were doing and enjoying back the last time we did these kind of hangouts 5 years ago or whatever, so much of that time period was just characterized by the shields had not yet been fully raised on a lot of these things. Like if you even, and a good comparison is that Sam Hyde 2070 paradigm shift. He did that at the actual, now it was not like the main TED Talk thing, but he did that at one of their actual TED Talk things. And he actually managed to get them to give him that TED Talk time slot or whatever. And they would never in a million years allow someone, even not just Sam Hyde, because he's a known quantity at this point, but they would not let someone like that get through and do that now, because at that time there was not the awareness that sort of this movement, the alt-right or whatever, and people like that were just not on the radar enough at that time. And that's why we remember a lot of that as kind of a golden era, is that the system had just not yet, you know, it's like the Borg or whatever, where they adapt to the phaser frequency and then you have to keep changing it or whatever. They had not, adapted to the frequency at that time, you know?
Well, part of the way he got away with that too was, firstly, he did it at a TEDx talk. So the barriers to entry were much lower because they basically allow anyone to go and talk at those things. But also because he did game the system, he didn't say, look, I want to parody this. He obviously used all the correct buzzwords and so on, and that was his way of lowering their defenses. I'm optimistic though that these things will come through. They might have to start small and local. I think that's one of the big issues going forwards, that we're not going to be able to release a Hollywood blockbuster, that kind of stuff. But I think that in many ways it will be a healthy return to having local culture rather than than this sort of global monolith, if you like.
Let me tell you about something that I was hoping that this would come up sometime in Millennial, because I realized this a few months ago and I've been waiting to talk about it. And I dare say I'll talk about it in my weekly show next year. It's just an observation that I made. At some point, I think just before COVID, I think it was going to be, there was going to be a Kraftwerk concert in London. I think it was going to be May 2020. And I bought tickets for it. And a few months early, January or something, whenever it was. And in order to buy tickets for this concert, I was directed from the Kraftwerk website to the venue's website, which then directed me to a website called festticket.com, which obviously is short for festivalticket.com. And this is something that I've really wanted to talk about, because it's very interesting in terms of illustrating how the control is done. Now, basically, FestTicket is in the 2000s, a venue would sell tickets online and there would be a PayPal kiosk. And you'd just press the PayPal button and you'd put in your email address and the tickets would be sent to your email address from the website, from the venue's website. That's how it would be done then. But now it's all handled by FestTicket, which is a central thing that, a central platform that I imagine handles the tickets for thousands of different venues worldwide. And, well, what that means is that you only have to register once, which is with FestTicket. You don't have to enter your details, your card details, or your email address with any of these venues, their websites. So you only have to do it once. And what's interesting about FestTicket is it's centralization. So it means that if a venue were not imposing COVID mandates for people, then FestTicket could say, okay, you can't use FestTicket anymore. You're going to have to handle this yourself. And that means that a lot of people will not want to enter their details. So you'll get fewer ticket sales. Or if a venue were to allow an act who had said something racist, and FestTicket might say to them, okay, if you do this again, if you allow this act to perform at your venue again, you're going to be banned from FestTicket. And so on. So in other words, it's this, it becomes all homogenous. And that's how control is exercised in the real world. So venues then have to, and this applies to hundreds of, I'd imagine thousands of venues are now under the control of this website. Ticketmaster will be the same thing. So you only have to take over these two companies, and then you've got control over the cultural tenor of thousands of different venues across the world.
Yeah, again, though, I'm optimistic, because I think that will become a festering ticket, shall we say, in that it will become very bland, and there will be an opportunity for local things that respond to local needs, local ideas. Again, we have to get away from this idea that we can organize Woodstock 3.0 or what have you, or that we can have a Hollywood blockbuster or what have you, that culture is going to have to be small and it's going to have to be local and it will arise organically in response to this bland monolith.
Yeah.
And people have to accept that they're not going to be able to become billionaires from these things. Our culture will go the way it was before, that people will make us an average living from it.
Yeah. Yeah. And just one other point about FestTicket is that it also means that everything is homogenized culturally, because there isn't a goth ticket website or an indie ticket website, you know. It's all the same now. So it's another aspect of globalization. But yeah, I agree with what you're saying, expat, that this does point the way to local culture. Eventually, I think we're going to be forced into it because the global behemoth is going to be so intolerant and streamlined and homogenized. Okay, so we'll get on to the super chats. If you want to post any, this is the time to do it now as soon as possible because we don't have that long. The crucifix is a rather morbid symbol. Why not a bunny for Easter? Isn't the point of Christianity getting candy? That's from Winter Phoenix Forest, Kieran. I don't know what he's talking about there. Okay. Now, Kit says, what is it about Islam that it gives such an identity and firm purpose to whole populations? If we could really understand the dynamics, we could learn very useful lessons for our own people. Well, I would have answered to that it's intolerant. It's very absolutist. It insists upon things. It makes demands. This is why I think liberal women have this secret fetish for Muslim men. But also the Muslim men, I think Islam appeals to the mindset of the Arab. It's hot-headed, it's sensual, but it's also quite warlike, it's aggressive, it's very masculine. And when I say sensual, I guess the word would really be sexual. But it's all about domination. And I think that's there. I think that, and I hope that's not too shrill or black and white of me, but I think that Islam, there is a reason. It has to be to some extent commensurate with the mentality of the people for whom it is intended. Otherwise, there would just be a terrible mismatch and it would never take. So that's what I would say about that. Expat, do you want to comment on this?
Look, it's probably just the difference between render unto Caesar, that sort of idea that Christianity wasn't all-encompassing. It wasn't a political ideology as such, whereas they don't have that distinction in that other religion.
Right, okay. This is from Winter Phoenix Forest, Kieran, and he's making a reference to something I don't understand. Franklin, has a cheerful girl with green hair and an affinity for water shown up at your farm yet? If she does, be honest about which axe you dropped. She'll give you a golden axe, then go and use it to fight against those annoying harvest sprites. You're welcome for the advice. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, it's a reference to this thing called Harvest Moon, apparently some anime series. Several of my subscribers are trying to get me to watch this. I've said I'm not really into anime, but they've said to me I should watch this because it's literally my life. And it's like my life in anime form, so I should watch it for that reason. So I think it's a reference to that.
Okay, all right. Gus Faze says, just wanted to say that the three of you were my introduction to the alt-right. Thanks for everything and happy Yule. Well, thank you very much, Gus Faze, who's also doing excellent moderation, by the way, in the live chat.
This stream tonight ought to supply the movement with another 100,000 probably new converts, I'm thinking.
Well, ideally. Gus Faze also earlier said, this may be an uncomfortable topic, but one of my favorite expat vids was his post-Charlottesville response. Has your view on these issues changed, Franklin? What are all three of you, what are your personal thoughts on the pivot of things post-Charlottesville, the civil trial, and whether or not we're past all of that now? Pale Hominid, would you take this?
Sure. Yeah, maybe I'm the only one legally allowed to take this. I don't know. I would say, I was just thinking about this recently because of the trial and whatnot. That was one of the things that I thought was most emblematic of that whole effect I talked about earlier, where energy successfully like dissipated and redirected and whatnot. I think that the reaction they had to Charlottesville was very calculated to try and just be like, this is something we have to teach these guys to never try to show their heads in public again. Like just the way they wheeled out all their most powerful spells of like media manipulation and mischaracterization and, you know, it would actually be interesting to see how much they could have done in the same regard had the car accident not taken place. You know, had that not taken place, could they have still effectively achieved approximately the same thing, or does it all hinge on there being a death? Is that why they were able to do it? I'm not sure. I think that because of the nature of that event, even if nobody had gotten hurt, or at least nobody on that side had gotten hurt, I think they would have still tried to really use it as a moment to squelch things. I don't know. It would definitely be interesting to see that alternate reality where that didn't happen and what happened afterward.
It's possible that such events would have been tolerated until a similar thing did happen. And then they would have done what they did with... Because let's not forget, it wasn't the first alt-right rally. There had been several before that. But it was Charlottesville because the car accident happened. And I suspect that if it had taken another five rallies, eventually something would have happened that they could easily use.
Well, especially because these people are in the habit. I mean, you see it at all these Black Lives Matter things. It's still happening now. There was a woman in New York who's going to trial because she refused a plea deal for this kind of thing. That they do, the Black Lives Matter and stuff, they do this thing of surrounding cars, and all it takes, basically, it's an amazing sort of psychological thing that, like, if you, it's an interesting phenomena to examine. All it takes is one of these, like, rioter types to sort of pound on the hood of the car, then that evokes enough panic from the person that they start behaving a certain way, then that fuels the reaction of the people around them. And so it's just this thing that builds on itself. And, you know, I think that because of that dynamic and how they like to surround and pound on cars and stuff, something like that was probably inevitable to eventually happen. And while there may be some understanding of, like, a mom in New York with her daughter in the car panicking and stuff, that no understanding will be extended towards someone who's, you know, a openly white advocate who's at a meeting for that purpose. Like, that's the thing. You could be, the same exact event could happen, and if you're some mom who was just trying to drive to work or whatever, people will be like, yeah, you'll have a substantial number of people who are in your corner on that. If you're someone who is a racist or whatever, then they will literally turn you into, like, the devil and give you 400 years in prison or whatever, even though the same basic event took place.
Yeah. I mean, this is what shows the utter fakeness of the reality that we live in now, the social reality that we live in now. Because Daryl Brooks in Waukesha or Waukesha, I can never remember how to pronounce it since Jared Taylor corrected me the other night, he did something worse. I mean, what he did was undeniably much worse. It was a different order of magnitude worse than what James Alex Fields did. And yet nobody knows about him. It's out of the news cycle. And the only article is one where he says that he feels demonized. The difference is, it could not be starker.
Two things on that, by the way. Just because everybody seems to be getting it wrong, and I happen to have had some previous familiarity with that city, it is pronounced Waukesha, just to let you know. The one thing that's interesting about the media coverage and whatnot, actually, our guys, a media company that is associated with TRS, they went in and did some jailhouse interviews with him, and they were the only media that actually pursued any kind of real investigative efforts with him were alt-right media. And they've got a documentary coming out very soon. I believe the company is called Media to Rise, and they've got a documentary about the Waukesha thing coming very soon. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
You should ask Mike Enoch about it. He's very familiar with that whole thing.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, it's just astounding, the contrast. Franklin, do you want to say anything about Charlottesville?
Not really, for two reasons. One is, aside from the obvious, but one is that I actually can't really remember very much about what I said in the wake of that, in the video in the wake of it. Pardon me. And the other thing is that I haven't been following it since then. Haven't followed anything. I don't even know what the outcome of any of that was. So
okay.
I can't really comment. Yeah.
All right. The Economist had yet another article unironically claiming that Europe needs Muslim and African migration to counter the falling European birth rate and so save the welfare state. They seem to really believe this insanity, despite all the evidence. What explains such ingrained delusions? I don't think they really believe it. I don't think anyone really believes it. I think
does anyone even read it. The Economist? Who reads that these days?
I don't know, but I just find it hard to imagine that anyone really believes that Europe needs more. I mean, it's just so obviously insane. I think it's just social. Yeah, it's social pressure and career pressure that leads somebody to write things like that. I mean, I don't know, maybe some, again, maybe I'm speaking too soon. Maybe there are champagne socialists who are actually that deluded even now.
They don't necessarily like The Economist, though. That's the weird thing. I can't quite figure out who their target audience is anymore. It seems to be a rapidly diminishing audience because people on the left really dislike that because, you know, neoliberalism and all of that. And then more and more people on the right are rejecting neoliberalism also. They seem to have a pretty rapidly diminishing target audience for that magazine. Maybe that's enough. Maybe as long as they get, people working at Deutsche Bank or something reading it, that's enough because they have a small cadre of followers in important positions or something. I don't know.
It could just be a sort of establishment magazine for Davos, man. Possibly. Yeah,
think
so. Okay, there is Mike Mack says, I do a killer impression of the Franklin telling Sargon, why doesn't he just get the fuck out of here?
Well, no offense to Pale Hominy, but he wasn't my first preference for a reunion stream.
Well, unfortunately, Sargon wasn't prepared to appear this year. I doubt he'll ever appear again. I mean, I would assume that he won't. I think his days of interacting with more edgy types are over, and I think he actually wants to be seen as the edgiest thing on YouTube because at this point he basically is, so he doesn't want to give exposure to anything, you know.
You need edgy. To arrange a Sargon Spencer reunion triumvirate.
Fuck's sake, yeah.
Sargon.
That was hilarious. That was a classic moment just before all of that came crumbling down. Anyway, there is one last super chat, and it is from SF, who's known to us from the old days, and he says, just like old times, Merry Christmas, Woes, PH, and Expat. And he makes a generous super chat. So thank you very much, SF, and it's nice to see you here. I know that you've been looking forward to this stream, and I hope that it hasn't let you down. So, Pale Hominid and Reactionary Expat, the Franklin, thank you for doing this. I think it has been something that a lot of people have wanted, so I'm glad that we were able to arrange it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was good to talk to you gentlemen again, and I'll see you in another 5 years.
Okay. All right. Okay, well, I'll be back in about half an hour with the final stream for tonight. In the meantime, I hope you all enjoyed this. See you later.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.